This track is titled Discharging Student Loan Debt with HJR 192 Remedy. There are lots of ways to discharge a debt or to discharge someone's duty. When you get discharged from the military, you do not have any other obligations to them. Notice how when they close a court case, they say the case is dismissed. They don't say that the case is discharged, although you can discharge a court case as well. When you were kids and you were in classroom, the teacher would tell you, okay, the bell rang, class is dismissed. They don't say class is discharged, okay? There is a difference. When you're done with school on your last day of school, class is discharged. But if you have to come back the next day and you have a duty to show up and to perform, it's not discharged, it's only dismissed. So that's the difference between discharge and dismiss. What you want is you want things to be discharged if you don't want them to come back up again. Dismissed means they can reconvene class another time, they can reconvene the court case another time, they can open the court case back up another time. If you're discharged from the military, you do not have to continue to do anything for the United States Army, Navy, you know, whatever it is that you're a part of. So when we talk about discharging, credit or loan accounts like student loans. And this applies not just to student loans, this applies to other types of private loans, credit cards, and things of that nature. But I wrote up this little document that I wanted to put out there as a disclaimer to people who are not that far down the rabbit hole. And maybe those that are listening to this are, and maybe some people aren't. So I hope that everybody can get something from this, but this was specifically written to cater to people who are not that far down the rabbit hole with all the disclaimers of what they need to know before they think about getting involved with this, or before they decide and jump in to get involved with this. There's a lot of things and factors to consider, and anybody that's not giving you all of the disclaimers that exists before you do something is doing you a disservice, in my opinion. So my goal here is to put out this information as a service so that people can know whether or not discharging of a student loan or any other debt is for you or not. Now, when we talk about discharge in these loan accounts, the title is document is Discharging Student Loan Debt with HJR 192 Remedy. That's going to be the topic of this record of this. Obviously, you can discharge debts other ways. Okay? You could go through a bankruptcy. Now, I know student loans are typically not dischargeable through a bankruptcy. I get that. Credit cards are, other types of loans are, mortgages are, etc. Although it doesn't release the lien on the real property in a mortgage, but the mortgage debt is not, you don't owe the mortgage debt anymore. Your bank accounts can't be levied, other property can't be liened that doesn't already have a lien on it, and you can't have your wages garnished to pay a mortgage debt if it's been wiped out in a bankruptcy. Bankruptcies do discharge debts. I'm not taking that away from them. I am not a fan of bankruptcies. If you put something on the bankruptcy application or leave something off the bankruptcy application, one little thing, one zero in the wrong place, one T crossed wrong, the wrong angle, and you will get in trouble for bankruptcy fraud. It is a federal felony. 5-year prison sentence per conviction. If you have a prior criminal record, they sentence you to longer because you're a career criminal. It's not your first offense. But even first offenses, bankruptcy fraud, 5 years if you're lucky. You'll maybe only get 3 years. If it's for a large amount of money, then it's a longer time even than that. It could be 10 years. It could be a long, long time. So I'm not a fan of bankruptcy, especially when there are other safer ways to discharge debt that don't risk being accused of fraud and getting criminally charged and arrested and having to defend yourself and possibly go to prison for a long time. Once again, just in case that's over people's heads, if you file bankruptcy, the way that the statutory government allows you to discharge your debts. See, it's interesting. Discharging debt is something that even the system allows you to do. Even the corrupt government system allows you to discharge your debts. It's a recognized right among even the slave population that if you get so over your head in debt and you can't pay it, at least you have the opportunity twice in your life to wipe it out and start afresh and start anew. So even for the slave 14th Amendment property citizens that are owned by their slave owners from the government owning you due to the birth certificate being the title to your body, and they can regulate and control and tax and do anything they want from you, but even the government will allow you to wipe out some types of your debt. They won't wipe out IRS debt. They won't wipe out student loan debt. There are certain things that are not dischargeable, okay? Or that you, sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. You have to get a good attorney, get a good bankruptcy attorney, or do it yourself and know what you're doing and be able to assert those rights and have some experience. Most of you don't have experience doing, you know, pushing to get things wiped out and discharged into bankruptcy. But it is a right, and you can do it. However, it's typically going through their forms. It's getting permission from their court, and they have jurisdiction over the proceeding, and they can mandate that you give a list of all your assets. They can come into your home and check your assets. They could set up, make you have conferences with the bankruptcy trustee. And you're appointing a trustee to control and regulate all your property and all your assets for you and to account for everything. So you're giving them more control over you, which I don't like and I would not do. But it is an option for some people. Now, the other thing about discharging through the governmental allowance of bankruptcy is that they also, depending on the type of bankruptcy that you do and the way that you go about it, they can typically force you to sell everything. So what they're doing is taking everything that you have that's not exempt and giving it to the government so that the government can auction it off or pay the highest, you know, creditors in order of importance, and then they will discharge your debts. So when you discharge through a bankruptcy, you're not just wiping out all your debts. You also have to give up all of the things that you have. You have to give up everything, right? And then the government will say, okay, you have X amount of debt. Let's say they say you have $1 million of debt, but you only have $400,000 of property. So we're going to pay people in order of importance, and all creditors come and make a claim, and then the bankruptcy trustee will decide who gets paid and how much, and we'll try to pay everybody something, or we'll try to pay the person with the largest debt first, or, you know, different things of this nature, and then that's it. So if you're going to do a bankruptcy, a public bankruptcy, governmental permission, you know, bankruptcy, you're starting over from zero. You have nothing. Now, there are exceptions to that, because there are exemptions and exceptions where there's things called the Homestead Act, and there's things that will allow you to keep your only automobile, but you're not going to be able to have more than one automobile. Or maybe they make exemptions and allowances that you're allowed to have two automobiles because you live in the suburbs and husband and wife both work, or one of them takes kids to school, the other one takes the other car to work. So maybe they'll allow you to have two automobiles if you're a couple, but they don't allow you to have two automobiles for the use of the same individual. And they certainly, a boat is not a necessity. Certainly an airplane, you know, if you own your own plane, is not a necessity. So all the things that you own that are in your legal trust capital letters name are going to be eligible to be liquidated and sold and taken away from you. Now, this is one of the benefits of putting things in a trust, because if there are things in a trust, then it's not your property and it's not coming to be liquidated. So one of the tactics is that what you could do is just your all capital letters legal name could actually own nothing. Every car you have, home you have, you know, money, bank account, currency, gold and silver, computers, tables, chairs, personal effects, you know, mattress, bed, exercise equipment, books, printers, you know, studio equipment, musical equipment, books, libraries, collectibles, jewelry, watches, you know, everything that you have can be property of a trust or of several different trusts, and then you actually have nothing, and then what you put in the bankruptcy forms about your assets that you're disclosing to be liquidated is very, very, very little, if at all anything. Now, it may look weird if you say that you have nothing, so that's not necessarily the best strategy, is to say, oh, I have absolutely nothing. I own no clothes. I have no this. I mean, that's silly. That's going to raise a red flag in bankruptcy. They're going to say, really, you have no clothes? What are you wearing right now? And then you say, well, these clothes aren't my property. The clothes are the property of a trust. Well, that's just going to open up red flags if you say you have nothing. So maybe you can keep some stuff in your name, but have other stuff in trusts that is important to you that you would not want to liquidate. But it must be done correctly, because again, if you put wrong information on the bankruptcy forms and you do not disclose certain things, then if they determine that you were lying and that that was your asset and you weren't disclosing it, then you can get in trouble for bankruptcy fraud. So even with trusts, it's a dangerous situation, because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you put it on there, there's a liability, because they could take it away from you. Even if you put on there, because they have a section on there, do you have anything in trusts or whatever, you could say what it is and then try to defend it and prevent it from being liquidated, but then, you know, you're damned if you do, because what if they win? What if they're able to say, oh no, and they collapse the trust and they say it wasn't set up properly, and we're determining that it was your asset and now we're taking it and liquidating it for the bankruptcy. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because if you leave it off and then later on they come back and they determine that it was your property, they could hit you with bankruptcy fraud. So this is the reason why trusts need to be set up properly with a proper expert, and you have to have a high degree of reading and study material to have a high degree of confidence to know that you did set up correctly. Because if you are gonna, you know, that house is not mine, it's in a trust, and leave it off the bankruptcy form, if you're 100% accurate, you won't get into any trouble. But if you messed up and crossed one T in the wrong direction, then you could get in trouble for bankruptcy fraud. So trusts are very, very powerful things. It's what the richest, wealthiest people in the world have used for hundreds of years now, and you know, it's effective. Okay, but don't just think, oh, I just learned about these trusts, I'm gonna swap something into a trust and then fall bankrupt. There's a lot of liabilities, there's a lot of life lessons that I don't want you to learn, that other people have already learned, and there's a lot of reading, and there's a lot of court cases where all these things have already been decided if you just read the court cases. There's a great book, The Art of Passing the Buck, that explains all the main, you know, court cases related to trusts and the history of trusts. So anyways, my whole point with all that is bankruptcy to discharge debts, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't with putting information, and you definitely don't want to be in any trouble. So it's a sticky situation. Now, if you don't have any trusts and you just put everything on there and you let them take and liquidate and sell everything that you own, other than whatever is exempt, like your home and a car, well, if you're okay with having all the other stuff possibly taken away and then all your debts wiped out and start over with nothing, and you think that you're getting more than you're giving up, then that's an option for many people. It's an option for many people in the general public. It may be an option for you or not. I don't really help with people filing bankruptcy, but it's out there and the information is out there. What I do help people to do is the much safer, with less time. Doing a bankruptcy can take years to complete. It can take 1 to 3 years to complete. So I like doing the quicker, potentially more affordable, because if you hire a bankruptcy lawyer, depending on how involved it is and how many assets you have, it could wind up costing you a lot of money in the end over the course of years. Every time he has to go to court, every time you have to have a meeting with him, every time there's a motion in court that needs to be put in there. So it could be less expensive, or it could be more expensive, because you could do like a simple bankruptcy and get a really cheap bankruptcy lawyer that charges you a few hundred bucks and that's it, and just does some stuff for you and then throws it at you and then does a couple of consults on the phone and isn't really too involved, and you might be able to pay an attorney a few hundred bucks to do a bankruptcy. But if it becomes more involved, it could be much, much, much more than that, depending on the assets and what's at stake and what's at risk and how much help that you need. So I prefer this, above everything else, the safer method, which we're going to talk about, this HJR 192 bankruptcy procedure. It's safer for the reasons I just explained. It might be cheaper, but it might not. It might also, if you hire me directly, my company, it might actually cost more than the few hundred dollars you pay for a small bankruptcy attorney. I don't know, okay? It depends on the circumstances and there's a lot of circumstances on both ends. But it's safer, and I prefer where you can discharge the other debts, like the court cases and the student loans and the things that you can't discharge into bankruptcy because they're exempt from discharge. Okay, so we explained so far what discharge is, the difference between, discharge and dismiss. We explained the public mainstream method of discharging through a bankruptcy and some of the difficulties with that. And also the problem with a bankruptcy is you can only use it like once and maybe twice in your life. Generally speaking, they don't let people file bankruptcy for more than two times. You have to wait many years in between. There's, different circumstances there. So when you're dealing with the HJR 192 bankruptcy, you can discharge debts as much as you want, and you can do them over and over and over and over. So there's a big advantage there. So one particular way of discharging a debt is with HJR 192 remedy. We're not going to discuss potential other methods, although they may come up in the conversation. There's lots of people that are sending letters to, debt companies that they have a loan with, and saying, oh, please prove to me this, that, and the other thing. And if you don't, then I don't owe you nothing. Well, that's fine, and they might even not respond, and they might even go away for a while, but when they hit you up with a lawsuit 9 months later or a year and a half later, and you'll know that it wasn't discharged, and you'll know that they just didn't have the time and energy to reply to you in the way that you asked them to, but the debt wasn't discharged. They still came after you, or they sold it to somebody else who came after you, or they passed it to a law firm who came after you. So a lot of these other methods floating around that don't actually deal with completely discharging the debt do not really stand the test of time in the long term. And that's why my virtual exclusive availability helping people is with discharging with HJR 192, because the other methods just can pop up later. With one exception, and I'll just cover that to get that out of the way. I like being comprehensive in my lessons and covering everything from one corner to the other corner to the other corner, and I like covering all quarters of the house to show you the entire square footage of the house. And if you want to spend most of your time or all your time over here, you like the living room, that's fine. Or you want to pick that bedroom as your bedroom, that's fine. But I want to show you the entire house, right? I'm trying to sell you a house. I want to show you the entire house, or I just, you know, whatever. I want you to know the entire lesson of everything else that's out there, which is why sometimes I get off and I go on little tangents and then I come back around. That's just the way that I talk. So you must forgive me for that if you get a little confused, but it all comes back. Listen to it a second time or third time if you need to. So with that one exception, if you do send some letters back and forth and you claim the debt isn't yours, or they didn't prove it, or they didn't loan you any money, or they didn't do this, or they didn't respond in time to your, you know, asking them to prove whatever, and now you're claiming that the debt is discharged, that's fine. But if they come and sue you, now is your opportunity to completely discharge it, because if you defend the court case with an answer and discovery and motions and go to trial and pick a jury and prove to the jury that the bank doesn't know what it's talking about and they don't have substantial proof. Remember, if you're the one that's accused, the other party has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, or in a civil case, beyond a preponderance of doubt, actually. So that's 51%. So the plaintiff has to prove beyond 51% or preponderance of the evidence in front of a jury. If there's material facts or evidence in dispute that needs to go in front of a jury. If there's nothing in dispute, then it doesn't go to a jury trial. The magistrate just decides it. So if you go through the court process in front of a judge or in front of a jury and have the case decided, and the case is decided without... Oh, sorry. If the case is decided with prejudice, then the court case can never be, that dispute, that accusation can never be brought up ever again. Okay, if it's decided without prejudice, then it can be brought up again. Meaning the plaintiff, if they failed to get a judgment against you, they can file the same exact case, the same exact account, and they can try to defeat you from a different angle or at a different moment in time. They can go and basically get a second trial or a second chance at it. So if you're able to defend a lawsuit and you win the case with prejudice, meaning the plaintiff, Bank of America, let's say, was suing you for an unpaid credit card for 20 grand or a student loan or whatever it is, and you defended them and won, and the judge signed the judgment that the plaintiff, Bank of America's case is dismissed with prejudice, then your debt is discharged there. But there's not a lot of cases where that's going to happen. All the cases where I've seen where people have actually defended and used various things, everything was dismissed without prejudice. A lot of times the attorneys for the bank, they don't want any risk or chance of getting a loss under their belt on their resume. They want to be able to go through their life and say, you know, I won every court case I was involved with, or especially if they're a young attorney just out of law school, they don't want to lose their first case. They don't want to lose half their first cases. They want to win the first five cases. They want to say, oh, I never lost a case. I graduated from law school 2 years ago, but I have a perfect track record. I won all 10 cases for my clients. So they want, if they're representing the banks who are their clients, they want to be able to continue their career. So if you're giving them enough of a fight, they might back down and give up and voluntarily withdraw the case to get the case dismissed with their voluntary motion, The case will be dismissed, but it'll be dismissed on the plaintiff's request that the court close the case. And therefore, that'll be a dismissal without prejudice, meaning without prejudicing to the rights of the plaintiff to possibly have another case, have another claim, have another chance at it. So that's one option. Now, the other option is you can be the plaintiff and you can sue them before they sue you. And then if you get a positive judgment, then that where the judge agrees with you and signs your prayer for relief and signs your judgment order saying that you don't owe Bank of America, you don't owe Sally Mae any money, then there you go, your debt is discharged. So that is one possible way. I don't prefer these methods because it takes a lifetime of experience, it takes law school, it takes going to court, studying full time. You might as well go to law school if you want to learn. Or there's home study courses. We have a link to a very popular one on our website under the product section. It's called How to Win in Court. But it takes a lot of time. You could take a whole year off and just study that and learn, and you still won't have enough experience because you haven't been to court dealing with a lot of different court cases. Some of you have. There's a lot of people on my membership list here that have a lot of experience. But for 90%+ of you, you don't have the experience. And for people out there in the general public, they don't have the experience. And the lawyers are not going to be able to assist you in defending your cases, suing credit card companies and student loan companies or different things like this to try to, you know, that's not really the line of work that they're in. They're inside the status quo, inside the box. And you're going to have to really find a special attorney if you want to go that route. So that's one option, but it's not my preferred option, and we basically don't really do it unless it's by absolute special request. But I don't like it. I don't like coaching people on battling court cases that can drag on for a while. Sometimes you don't hear anything for 6 months. Sometimes you don't hear anything for a year, and then it pops up again, and they file a motion, and then you have 20 days to respond, otherwise the other side wins. Well, who wants to be on standby for the rest of your life until, you know, and you know that you have there's a mandate where you have to respond by a certain period of time, like automatically by surprise. These things happen. So who wants to deal with a lawsuit? It's not a fun thing. When you're involved with a lawsuit, even if it's something that you're on top of, it's something that's just kind of like clouding your life. Unless there's a big payoff and you're extraordinarily confident that you're going to win and you're going to win big money, then it's really not, you know, you have to really be particular about, you know, picking your battles, okay? Especially if it's someone that's trying to sue money against you, you know, by you spending the next year or two of your life, who knows when it's going to end, questionably, you know, trying to fight it, you're not really gaining anything from winning. All you're gaining is if you win, it says you don't owe the debt, and they could possibly bring it up again. Or if you cause enough of an arm wrestle, they'll voluntarily withdraw and they can always bring it up again. So it's not really worth it. The worst that can happen is if you fight for 2 years and then the court determines, oh yeah, this person does owe the money to Bank of America, you're back to where you started with in the beginning because Bank of America already thought, you know, that you owed the money. They were already in collections against you and they already were trying to get the money from you. So your worst case is that you spend this time, you don't move forward with the other goals in your life, and you are fighting a court case that who knows if you're going to win or you're going to lose. And if you win, you're still not that better off, unless, of course, you're countersuing them for money for violations of Fair Debt Collection Practices Act or something of that nature. And if that's the case and you have confidence that you can win, then by all means, go for it, and I applaud you. And we may be mentoring people with that strategy in the future. We just don't have the time to launch a course about that right now. Bottom line, folks, is lawsuits, stay out of it unless you have to. And normal dispute letters back and forth, what people typically in our industry here call a private administrative process, which is sending letters to the company and telling them if they don't respond and prove this in an affidavit that they don't have anything against you, and blah, blah, blah. And the bottom line is that I can summarize the private administrative process stuff in one word. It's basically horseshit if you don't have a lot of other components in place ready to slam it and completely discharge it, which is what I'm about to talk about. So, but what I'm saying is just sending a series of three letters, a 1, a 2, and a 3, and getting affidavits of non-response and certificates of service and things signed is not necessarily sufficient, and it's just private out-of-court stuff. They could always sue you, and they're not going to listen, and they're not going to agree with you, and they're always going to point back to the original contract, and they're not going to move off of that contract being what they believe is the valid contract, and that you know their performance and utilizing of the credit card or utilizing of the loan accounts and going to school and having it paid for. They're always going to point to the same arguments, and it's only going to wind up when you wind up in court in front of a jury or a judge. And I think the jury's going to side in favor of the financial institutions because the jury doesn't understand what your arguments are. And it's very easy for the jury to understand, well, if you went to school, then you have to pay your loans. Well, if you borrowed a credit card, you purchased things on the credit card, you have to pay your credit card debt off. Well, if you bought a home and you took out a mortgage to pay the seller, you know, at the closing and you got in there without paying your money, then you agreed to pay the mortgage company back over so-and-so amount of time. And they don't see any further than that. And so the jury and the judges are not going to rule in your favor the majority of the time if you go in with those arguments, okay? So I really prefer discharging with HJR 192. Again, I feel it's the safest, the most effective, the shortest, possibly the least expensive, but you have to look at a lot of different factors of how much your time is worth and how much money do you earn per hour, what's an hour of your time worth, and various different things, how many accounts you have, if you, you know, there's a lot of different things. So I'm just going to read this document and then talk about whatever other issues come up, because I already had pre-written this. Discharging student loan debt with HJR 192 remedy. One of the advantages of being a secured party creditor is asserting your right as one of we the people of one of the United States of America, the Constitutional Republic. The people have rights under common law and equity. Okay, the persons don't, the all capital letters birth certificate names, but the people, the living men and women, the sovereign living men and women, we're going to call the people have rights under common law and equity. Equity, just basically, when you see that term, means fairness. The property slave, 14th Amendment citizen slaves who were created with the birth certificates and who have not discharged their birth certificates through the secured party creditor American national status process do not have rights under common law and equity. So do you understand the difference? Hold on, I want to close down this window. Okay. But as one of the people, the grantors and beneficiaries of the Constitution, you have a right of equitable relief, because when the government took the people's property and gold away in 1933 via House Joint Resolution 192, and the National Emergency Act, we would just call that HJR 192 for short going forward, the people can assert the right to equitable relief. When you assert the right to discharge, it is done. There's nothing more that you have to do other than just wait for it to go through. When the government took the property and labor of the American people became, quote, creditors in a creditor-debtor legal relationship. Okay, so if you're new to that, you may want to Google and look up what is a creditor-debtor legal relationship. It's another little rabbit hole. If a creditor is, but it's basically like you take out a mortgage or a credit card or something like that, or an auto loan, it creates a creditor-debtor relationship. And it can either be secured or unsecured. Secured by the property of the debtor or not secured by any property. Like a credit card is an unsecured loan account, okay? But when the government took the property, labor, and sovereignty of the American people, the American people became a creditor now to the United States government, who took substantive property that had substantive value. So the U.S. government was a borrower to the American people, and the United States government is the debtor, and the American people are creditor over the United States government. But it doesn't work if you're a 14th Amendment birth certificate slave, because you've given up your rights in exchange for benefits and privileges of the status of being a, quote, United States citizen, quote, which is a very specific, narrow legal construct of a meaning, which means that everything that you do is regulated and run by the United States corporation, and that everything you do is by special applications, registrations, benefits, and privileges. You do not assert that you have any rights other than the rights that they are willing to grant you as a privilege, just as an afterthought. You don't have any rights and you're our slaves, but we're going to give you a whole bunch of rights just so that, you know, you stay asleep in the matrix and you think that you're free and you just go to your job and you don't think about it too much and you don't try to fight to change the system and you don't do research to try to learn how to get out of the system and assert your sovereignty. So that's basically what they do. All your constitutional rights and things like that, you already had those rights under the Articles of Confederation, but even before that, you already had those rights. The Declaration of Independence, but the Declaration of Independence is just a supporting document and a reference for you to point to and say, here, it's recognized by intelligent, intellectual, established businessmen and founders of the country and intellectuals, and the people agree with this, and this has stood the test of, you know, it's acceptable for people, or, you know, to believe that. It makes sense. If you were to stop 100 people on the sidewalk and say, do you believe in the Declaration of Independence that there are self-evident truths and that all people have the right to this, that, and the other thing, freedom of speech, this, that, 100 people will tell you, yeah, of course. I mean, you might get some Sharia law people that, you know, that disagree, and whether they tell you that or they don't talk to you or they speak a different language, that's different. But when you deal with American people or civilized people in the Western world, pretty much it's accepted that we have these unalienable rights. And even the governments and the UN and all these people, all these agencies have had to acknowledge and respect and say, yeah, of course you have those rights. We know you have those rights. Because what happens when they really infringe upon our basic rights? Well, we go and we storm the king's palace and we chop off his head. This is what has happened all throughout history. So over the course of time, in order to stop us from chopping off the king and queen's heads, you know, from too much taxation and elsewhere, they've given us these rights, but they only granted or gave us these rights. It's like the Native Americans. They granted the Native Americans these reservations, but the Native Americans were already here and using the land and had their footprints all over the land. And that's something, according to common law, if your foot, you know, back in the day when they didn't have county recorders to record, you know, the square footage of what your property was, if your footprints were on, you know, were over here, then that was an extension of your land, your acreage, your area of land. And that's why they put the footprints on the birth certificate too as well. So there's a lot to, you notice how, I mean, they only take your footprints on the birth certificate, but everything else is just fingerprints, and nobody ever, you get arrested, nobody takes your footprints ever again. But this whole footprint thing has to do with owning the land, you know, as a sovereign man. But anyways, so the 14th Amendment slaves, the U.S. citizens don't have any rights. They have benefits and privileges. So again, if you're going to assert under doctrines of equity and fairness, and which, you know, which is part of common law, and you're going to demand that the government do something to you, or fulfill on something for you that you have as a matter of a right, you need to assert it as a national and not as a United States citizen. When the government took the property, labor, and money of the American people became creditors in a creditor-debtor legal relationship. If a creditor is owed money from the debtor who borrowed money, according to UCC and creditor-debtor law, the creditor can assert the right to a set-off of the credit owed to it. I mean, you don't even need UCC. This is just basic. Think about it in your private life. When you and your brother or your friend, one person borrows, oh, I got to run out the door. Oh, I see your wallet sitting right here. Can I grab $100 out of it and, like, pay you later? And then, you know, vice versa, something happens later. The other person owes $200 back. Oh, instead of me giving you $200 so you can give me $100 back, why don't I just give you $100? Right? Have you ever done anything like that? You have a right to do that. You know, so there's no UCC code you need to apply. You know, you need to, it's a code. It's what the, you know, people involved with international commerce, private international commercial law, even before governments, everybody acknowledges that, but it's even in common law, you have a right to set off. So when this is done, when this set off of the credit owed to it, so let me just back up a second. Again, if the American people allowed the government to take all its stuff in 1933, and the government owes something to us, therefore, of equal or greater value, otherwise it would be theft or treason, right? You can't just take something without agreeing that you owe it back of equal or greater value. So if they took all our stuff and sold it and gave us the money equivalent fair market value for it, or gave us the exact same stuff back, or at some point in the future gave us everything back and more, then that would be fine. Otherwise they could get into trouble because it would be theft what they did. So knowing this, they put in HJR 192 that all the American people's debts can be discharged as long as we notify the government and assert that right. So this is HJR 192. It's as simple as that. The government owes us a lot, and if you have a $100,000 student loan, you can demand and require that they discharge that, because back in 1933, your ancestors, which you're an heir of, right, had more than $100,000 taken from them. And you have a right to order them to do a set off of what they've taken from all the American people divided by the number of American people and their descendants and heirs, and you have a right to discharge. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. So when this process is done, it works. And when this process is done, there's no checks, there's no money orders, there's no bond, there's no promissory notes, there's no EFT, there's none of this stuff that some of these other people are trying to use to try to discharge or set off or pay some of these debts. And a lot of people are getting in trouble for writing these set off bond or set off money order instruments, or they just draft up these promissory notes to try to replace the old debt that they have, which doesn't make any sense, because if you sign a promissory note, now you have another new debt. So you replaced an old debt with a new debt, and it was substantially the same debt. And there's a maxim in law that says that when you try to replace one thing with something else exactly the same, it's a nullity. I'm trying to remember exactly what we just recall from doing this. So it's not anything different than the original debt. It's just a derivative of the original debt. Okay, it's just, you got your name changed. You get, you know, It's like this. If you get criminally charged and they criminally charge the name on your birth certificate, you don't just go to court and get and do a legal name change and then you're out of it, because it's substantially the same thing. When there's no substantive uniqueness to a thing, it upon inspection, the courts have routinely collapsed it as the same original thing. Your legal name being changed is substantively the same thing, the same trust as your birth certificate name. It doesn't fix anything. And so there's all these people trying to get their names changed now, and it doesn't do anything because it's the same thing. If you were to give birth to a baby and have a new life and have a son or a daughter, that would be a new substantive thing. You give them a new brand new name and they're a different entity, not liable for anything that you've done. That's fine. Or you have one corporation that's involved with a certain type of a business, has a certain board of directors, has a certain shareholders, does a certain type of business, that's fine. You create a different type of business in a different niche and or with different directors and or with different shareholders and or possibly with different offices, and they are substantively different things. Now you can have some things overlap. You can have the same owner own multiple companies, but everything else is different about them. You can have the same companies work in the same office space. Hey, my office space is from 9 to 2, and then I leave, and this company comes in from 2 to 5, and then I leave, and this company comes in from 5 to 10. They do that. It's called virtual offices. So you could have the same exact address and physical office location, but you could be different entities, right? But if you have the same office locations, you sell the same products and services exactly the same for exactly the same prices, you have the same exact executives, president, CEO, etc., the same exact employees, the same exact shareholders, it's not a different entity, it's an alter ego. And it doesn't work like that. So that's that. So the reason why I explained that was because when you issue a promissory note and you say, I'm going to give Bank of America a new promissory note, or Citicards a new promissory note, or I'm going to give the student loan company a new promissory note in an attempt to discharge and set off the old promissory note, it doesn't work. Because if it did work, and there's a theory that it could work where the other debt is paid for with the new debt, but they're substantially the same thing and they're collapsed into the same they're derivatives of the same promissory note, of the same contract, of the same agreement, with the same terms, with the same parties. So they are the same thing. They're nothing different. And I've read court cases before. I think I have a court case on my desktop right now. You know, where people were trying to protect their assets and they put their home into an LLC and all these different things. And the courts just say, I mean, the attorneys for the creditors that were foreclosing on it said, there's no economic substance. You set up an LLC, but there's no economic substance. There's no business being run. There's no products being sold. There's no independent board of directors aside from the person who set up the LLC. There's no shareholders. It's just one guy paid $50 to the Secretary of State to set up an LLC and then transfer the home into the LLC. The LLC is a derivative of this guy. It's an alter ego of him. It's not anything different. So that's how they collapse the non-existent business. It's also called a sham business or a nominee or a front business or there's some other terms too as well. I can't come up with them off the top of my head, but I think that you get my point. Back onto this. So again, you can't set off one debt with the same exact debt and a new signature on it. It doesn't work like that. People have been trying to do this. I've studied it. It doesn't work. And people aren't getting success with it But when you actually discharge it using what I'm talking about, the creditor-debtor relationship as a secured party creditor and as a private citizen and as an American national, and you remind the government of all the laws or all the history with the National Emergency Banking Act, and then you point them as a fiduciary and you say, well, now you have a fiduciary contract. If they don't perform, it's fraud and it's theft, and they're personally liable for tort. They are personally liable. They cannot assert the immunities and protections that they were an employee of the Secretary of Treasury or they were employee of the U.S. government and they didn't have to listen to you. When you appoint them as a fiduciary and you tell them what they have to do and they don't do it, they can be personally liable. And that's the reason why they do it if you do this correctly and if you appoint them as a fiduciary, okay? So, there's no checks, bonds, money orders, promissory notes required in discharging debt. And this is why the people out there that are doing it. Now, there may be some successes that are out there, and even